we start with Jesus, of course, has appeared to Mary and told her to say to the disciples, I'm going to ascending to your Father and my Father and your God and my God and so forth. We did that last week. And then verse 19. Uses un upsias, a genitive absolute. Upsias, with omicron sigma on the end, is an adjective. It means late. But in the New Testament, the word is used as a feminine noun, he upsia, which means night, okay, lateness. So here, uses is the present participle active, feminine singular genitive of a me, to be, and linked with what's acting as a noun, so when it was night, something like that, or while it was night. Te hemera ekene, on that day, which one? Te mia sabbaton, the first of the Sabbaths. And, here's another genitive absolute, ton theron kekles menon, the door, literally, the doors having been shut. And if you take both of these as temporal, I think that works pretty well, although we'll see when we get to verse 26, I want to take a similar genitive absolute as concessive, just because it seems to fit more closely. But we'll take both these temporally, when it was late and while the doors were shut, hapu eizan hoi mathetai, where the disciples were, diatan phobon ton eudaion, on account of the fear of the Jews. This is a good example of an objective genitive, right? Phobon has a verbal notion in it, to fear, and Jews, in context, especially in the Johannine context, is the object of the fearing. The disciples are fearing the Jews. Jews meaning, as it so often does in John, the hostile Jewish leadership, because the disciples are Jews and they're not, presumably not afraid of themselves, at least not in the same sense. So, because they feared the Jews. Yeah, Paul?
Well, you know, I was wondering, you know, how often, especially today, that question of Jews is so sensitive that maybe we could translate it, the Judeans.
Oh, okay. Although that would leave the ambiguity then.
Then
but
you're thinking of a geographical spot.
Right.
And you're not thinking of my next door neighbor here in St. Louis.
Whose last name is Fishkowitz.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's not a, yeah. You could probably not lose much meaning and avoid a very sticky issue.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good thought. Right. And even, because even to translate Jewish leaders, it still may evoke some unintended meaning in the our current context.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good, good enough. So anyway, even all this is the double genitive absolute so far. This sets the stage for the main verb, which we now hit, eilthen ha Jesus, Jesus came, aorist indicative active from erchomai, kai este. Here's our friend histemi, which is still fresh in my mind because I just taught it to the beginning Greek students about a week ago. This is the second aorist active, so it has an intransitive meaning. It doesn't mean to transitively stand something up, but it means to be in the position of standing. Jesus stood, right? Eista mezon, into the middle of them, we assume, and he says to them, Irene himin, peace to you. This is the ordinary greeting. I suppose this is like shalom lecha. But in context, I think you can exegetically defend the notion that it's more than just hi, right? Jesus is, it is a traditional greeting, but this is the risen Christ. Full bore, theological, peace to you, right? And this, you know, you could pick up from earlier material in John, my peace I give to you, you know, all that kind of good stuff. So, verse 20, and tuto apon, after he had said this, take the participle as temporal, edeixen, he showed the hands, tas cheras, and the pleuron, and the side to him, echoing chapter 19, of course, where the nails and the sword have wounded his body. There's a strong theme of physicality here in this story. It's equally as strong as in Luke 24, where Jesus eats and he says, look, I'm not a ghost. You know, I have flesh and bones. And as obvious as that may seem, that's right at the heart of the message of this text, the utter reality of Jesus' resurrection from the dead. Now, end of verse 20, Echarizan un hoi mathitai, idantes tan kirion. They rejoice, therefore the disciples rejoiced. I want to translate this participle causally, because they saw the Lord. See? They had no joy before, they saw him, they had joy. Okay? And that's the sequence. That's the way it's already happened in a slightly different way with the beloved disciple who looks in the tomb, sees that he's not there, and it specifically says he sees and believes. Right? And Mary's message to the disciples in verse 18 is, I have seen the Lord. So seeing and believing is not bad. Okay? In fact, for these people in the story, it's the only way that faith could happen for them. It's God's idea that it's happening this way. Verse 21, then Jesus said to them again, peace to you. Just as the Father has sent me, and I still stand in a condition of being sent, I suppose, kago, also I am sending, or I send you. This is a strong theme in John. Jesus as the one who has been sent into the world to save the world, not to judge or condemn the world. His original purpose is to draw all people to himself and so forth. And now he's sending them. And I think you can, okay, derivatively, he's sending them to carry on that same salvific mission, right? Just as the Father sent me to bring salvation to the world, now you eyewitnesses, I am sending you to bring that salvation to the world. Verse 22, and after he had said this, and ephesemen, and he breathed, we normally supply upon them, although it's not there. Baptist exegetes who want to avoid any notion of office of the keys or anything like that, translate this, he sighed, right? Which I think is a little bland. He breathed and supply upon them, and he says to them, now we have the famous words for holy absolution. This is really the best passage, I think, better even than the ones in Matthew. Labata, receive Holy Spirit, the Holy Spirit. Now, this is a little awkward, but the sense is clear enough. You have on, which lets you know that you have a condition coming up, and tinon, of certain ones, af eta, you forgive the sins. This is the aorist subjunctive after on. They stand forgiven to them. Aphetontai is perfect, perfect indicative passive from aphiemi. So back it up. Of whomever, of certain ones, of whomever you forgive the sins, they are forgiven to them. And then in contrast, of whomever you seize, they stand as seized. Right? So the explicit power, the peculiar authority, as the old translation of catechism used to say, to forgive sins is hereby imparted to the apostles. And of course, then the question, we have this, you want to have a big fight about Kirche und Amt right now? We could go ahead and do that. We actually don't fight over this verse, do we? Not too much. We normally believe that this office is exercised publicly, at the very least, by the pastors who hand on the apostolic doctrine. But it's rooted in the resurrection of Jesus. See? So that, I think this is a point of some importance, lest we overemphasize one thing to the exclusion of the other. The only reason why these words are authoritative is because he's raised from the dead. Right? It's the resurrection, which is the gospel, and the word of absolution, which conveys what the resurrection has won and created, right? I actually heard a sermon one time on this text. I swear, on this text, the sermon had a question as its theme. How can you know your sins are forgiven? Answer, when the pastor says so. Was there any message about the resurrection of Jesus' body from the dead? No. Was there any emphasis upon the fact that it's Jesus who forgives sins, and the pastor's word is a derivative word, fully authoritative, right? No, it was all because the pastor says so. That was a terrible sermon. See? Now, when the pastor pronounces absolution, does it forgive my sins? Yes, it forgives my sins. Why? Because Jesus is raised from the dead. Because he has created the forgiveness of sins, and he has given that word to the pastor to say. Right? So it was a little on the one-sided side. I was pretty ticked, which is a theological term. Ticked. Tickizo means to be mad. Charles?
Verse 21.
Yes. Good question. I don't think so. John is constantly doing this. The most boring article I've ever read on the Gospel of John was by Leon Morris, you know, probably in some ways the leading New Testament exegete conservative, at least in the world. And what he does is he lists hundreds of cases in the Gospel of John where he just changes words, and it reminds me of Paul, what were the two verbs? Zamar and what was the other one? Seer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Sing. They're acting in this context synonymously, and I would say that's what's going on here. John does this all the time. Yeah, so it's send and send. And
it's a good illustration. You can't simply say, because a different word is used, aha, something different is going on.
Right,
You can't always do that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're simply intended interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
And so you always have to ask, is it an interchangeable equivalence, or is there an intentional difference?
Right, right.
That's tough to get at, you know,
right.
Sometimes. But like that agapao and phileo.
In chapter 21.
For example, I've heard a lot of sermons that make a point of saying, it's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody asked about that passage in Greek yesterday, because we use part of that text as an example of... comparative adjectives or something. And yeah, and it's interesting, if you check out the good commentaries, even the conservative ones, they'll simply say, no, John is just varying his terms here. He probably doesn't intend any real difference in meaning. Yeah. There is a book by Leon Morris, by the way. It's called Studies in the Fourth Gospel. And it's back already in the 60s, I think. And it was sort of foundational to his very, you know, in some ways magisterial commentary. That's still highly regarded, and I think in both liberal quote unquote and quote unquote conservative circles. And he has a series of very helpful studies in that book, and this is one of them. He calls them meaningless stylistic variations. Yeah. So I think that's what you've got going on here. See, but John is so simple that, you know, you can notice everything. At least I feel I can notice everything in John because the syntax is pretty straightforward, you know. And then when I see a different word, I go, gee, does this mean something? And I would say not unless you have some good reason for it to be taken that way. Yeah. So anyway, the resurrected Christ gives full theological spiritual peace to the disciples and then empowers them and their heirs, if you will, to speak this authoritative and effective word of forgiveness of sins and seizing or retaining of sins. Now, here comes the fun part, Thomas, verse 24. Thomas, one of the 12, the one who was called Didymus, which apparently means twin, ukein, was not, met auton, with them when Jesus came. Verse 25. Then, hoi aloi mathetai, the other disciples, either elegon, began to say or kept on saying auto to him, just what Mary said in verse 18. Except it's plural. Heo rakamen, we have seen the Lord. Notice that they're depending on their eyewitness status. We've seen him, right? But he, now we have the shift of subject, hadeh, but he, apen, said to them, eon me ido, unless, eon me, I see in his hands the place ton halon of the nails, and I throw, which probably means put, the finger of me into the place of the nails, and put of me the hand into the side of him, ou me pisteuzo. I will certainly not believe. Now, should Thomas have believed their report? Yeah, probably. In the same way that they should have believed Mary's report, right? But so, is Thomas being singled out here as somehow more doubting? I don't think so, see? But they got to be an eyewitness, and that's what he wants. He wants to be an eyewitness. Okay, and I think that the repetition of this second half of this incident, you know, with Thomas in focus, is meant to underscore for the reader the absolutely vital nature of the eyewitness account which is here being transmitted. Okay? I think that's the core theological issue, as we'll see when we get to the conclusion. Okay, let's see, verse 26. And after 6 days, again, Azon Ezo, Hoi Mathi Taiotu, the disciples were inside, and Thomas with them. Jesus comes. Now this genitive absolute, ton theron kekles menon, it's the same form. I wonder if maybe we ought to take this concessively. Jesus came even though the door was closed. You could take it temporally also, when the door was closed. And este, same form, he stood, estamezon, same. The parallelisms between the two halves of the accounts are striking. I mean, they're exactly, I mean, if anything, in some ways, Thomas comes out better. We'll see that in a minute. Jesus stands into the middle and said, peace to you. And then, eta, he says to Thomas, phera, bring the finger of you. Now, again, here's another example. You know, your related question, Charles. Before, he says, I want to ballo my hand. Jesus now says, phera, your hand. I don't think it means anything. Bring your hand here and see the hands of me, and bring the hand of you and throw, there we have ballo, into the side of me, and me ginu, stop being, I think it works well in context to have me plus the present imperative mean stop doing something, especially since we already know that he's not been believing. Stop being apistas, Allah, and then you have to supply the verb, be pistas, okay? Now, I don't think it's good to translate this, stop doubting. It means stop being an unbeliever. Stop unbelieving. Don't be unbelieving, but believing. Because Thomas doesn't believe that Jesus is raised from the dead. It's not like his faith is weak. He doesn't have any faith. He's an unbeliever. Now, Jesus appears to him, says, don't be an unbeliever, be a believer. Right? And Thomas really hits a home run here. I mean, in the first half of the story, the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Right? Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God, one of the strongest direct acclamations of Jesus' deity in the whole New Testament, for crying out loud. Right? We take these both as vocatives. Right? Jesus says to him, now this could, it's punctuated as a question, and I think it could be a question. I also think it could be a statement. Because you have seen me, you have believed. Or it could be, have you believed because you have seen me? In any case, if there is a rebuke here, it is extremely slight, right? The punchline comes, I think, with the second half of verse 29. Blessed are the ones not seeing and believing. Blessed are those who do not see and believe. I think Jesus' words are projecting out here into the future, right? Pronouncing a blessing upon those who will not see and believe, but why will they believe? Answer, here it comes in verse 30 and 31. Because they will have the eyewitness testimony about Jesus to create faith for them. Verse 30. Many things then also, many other signs also then Jesus did before his disciples, which uk estin gegra mena, which do not stand written in this book. On the one hand, that's true. Da, on the other hand, but these stand written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Or, Don Carson argues, he has a good argument, so that you may believe that the Christ, the Son of God, is Jesus, and so that by believing, life you may have in his name. John more than the synoptics, you know, explicitly accentuates the saving power of the apostolic word. Right? 17:20. I not only pray for these, but for those who will believe in me through their word. And that's what this little sort of mini conclusion is doing too, right? So that Jesus did a whole bunch of other signs. And I didn't write about those, but I wrote these signs, and I would argue climactically the sign of his death and resurrection, so that you may believe. And this is all you need to believe now, right, is what I have written about the signs of Jesus. Yeah.
Oh. With how you're interpreting this commentary, the other book, as I've been sending you, now this side is again the last statement, it kind of fits better in that sense than the Thomas story that's not relating to his doubt.
Right.
To the apostles I would have seen.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. I really.
It hinges so much on the way we interpret that punctuation.
Uh huh.
By making a question, it almost emphasizes doubt.
Right. Right. See, the thing I like about this is it's very Lutheran. See? Now, for the first generation of those chosen as eyewitnesses, and you know how strong the testimony theme is, and all the things that give testimony to Jesus' identity as the one who the Father has sent. Now, this is the last and greatest testimony, and they saw the testimony, right? Now, what is sufficient for faith for all generations hereafter? Answer, the Word. The eyewitness testimony. This Word is sufficient for faith. Yeah, Paul?
But I think there's, maybe we Lutherans haven't picked up on this, but the emphasis is on our faith is founded on their eyewitness testimony. So it's not, there is a sense in which it's not just we believe anybody who says, I saw a Martian yesterday, because we just believe everything.
Right, right.
But it's, this is an eyewitness testimony that which has credibility.
Right.
I don't want to push that to say we can prove scientifically beyond the shadow of the doubt that Jesus is the Christ.
No.
But we don't have to say, it's just a matter of faith.
Right.
See, the emphasis here is there were eyewitnesses,
right,
and we do have their accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem is, biblical scholarship is totally, historical critics have totally canned that idea for centuries.
Right.
And so now, these aren't the apostles writing this, and they weren't really eyewitnesses, mm-hmm, and this never happened and all that.
Right.
But you sure do get that sense that it's pretty important for them to hear the word of eyewitness.
Right, right. And John's whole emphasis upon signs is almost uniformly positive. I mean, signs are, they don't always do it, but they're supposed to elicit faith. In Jesus chastises his opponents in John. If you don't believe because of my words, he says, believe because of the signs. See? And John explicitly, these signs have been written. So, for the manifestation of the one whom the Father has sent into the world, I mean, what counts is not just what he says, but what he does, his signs. Right? And then, again, I love it because it's so Lutheran, then that word about the signs is filled with power, right? And that word, not just any word, like you said, not just any word, but that word has power to create faith in Jesus as the Christ, the Son of God. Yeah.
Yeah. Did,
yeah, exactly. You know, it's not just making stuff up, right? Yeah. Right. Right. His wonders, his portents, right? See, this is where the C.H. Dodd school, and also in its most exaggerated form, you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt, but the J.A.T. God is Dead Robinson approach is really helpful, because these are no people's fundies. You know, these are no man's conservative, and yet it's a whole part of English scholarship on the fourth gospel that argues very strongly for John as historical testimony and data. And in one sense, those people are our friends, because nobody can accuse them of having a conservative agenda. And yet they bring forth a lot of positive arguments about John simply being at least as reliable as the synoptics. Of course, we would agree with that. But means something else by it in terms of relating what Jesus may actually have said and done. But I looked recently, I looked at my copy of the Five Gospels by the Jesus Seminar. You know how much Jesus talks in John. It's not as much as Matthew nearly, but he talks a lot. Guess how many sayings are in red in John? Guess how many? Zero. Guess how many are pink? One verse. And the rest is gray and black. I mean, that is unbelievably skeptical about the fourth gospel. So, anyway, we got to go. So, doubting Thomas? I doubt it. At least if it's there, it's not important.
So it's unbelievable.
I think so. Yeah. It's not, I mean, John only uses the other bit.